Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We've had some really insightful little pieces of gems of information, and I'm particularly interested in CIM. I used to be an examiner, a chief examiner for many years for CIM, and seen a range of things coming through, but really excited because CIM are about to launch their new products this March, and I know we've got a launch in Manchester, so that's good. Okay, so now we've got quite a time. We've got about half an hour before lunch. Lunch is at 1 o'clock. To debate and discuss, and it might just be comments rather than questions perhaps suggestions that you want to bring to the floor here. Clearly our guest speakers here have a wealth of background and experience. They'll be help us hopefully to really pull through the issues for the changing role of the marketing function. I wonder whether we should start really with what Alistair was saying, which was, how will business schools put the marketing function at the centre of management decision-making and recognise its business-critical role for universities and business schools? And to me, it's does that happen now with you, or are there barriers, big barriers? I don't know whether... Should we go to Alistair first for your thoughts on that?
Yes. I think it varies from business school to business school, university to university school, about how much influence marketers have over strategy and how much say they have influence they have. My view is that so many of the biggest challenges that business schools face, a marketing input and marketing brain will help them solve that, from international partnerships through to pricing. I think pricing is a really interesting one. I'm amazed by how many universities don't get their marketing teams at all involved in their pricing decisions. I mean, if marketers don't know their customers, then sort of who will do? I would go as far as saying course design and sort of product design. I think that's actually something which marketers could have a lot of value in, as people who really understand the customers and the markets that you're operating in. So the simple answer is I think they should be at the heart of things. I think making the case to be at the heart of things is often the challenge. I thought your comments were really interesting about having access as well. And I think access to the dean of the business school or pro vice chancellor, depending on the structure of the university, is absolutely crucial. I'm always pleased when I visit, and this is maybe a minor point, but I think an important point. I'm always pleased when I visit universities where the lead person for marketing external relations sits in the same corridor as the vice-chancellor or the dean of the business school. And I think that absolutely makes a huge difference. I think having that easy access, that being able to pop your head around the door and talk to things, and it's a two-way thing. It's not just the marketing person going to them, but it's the dean or the vice-chancellor being able to pop their head around the door to the marketing person. And I think you do see those relationships happen in some places, and I think they tend to be the places which are doing more innovative things. Their strategies are more well developed.
Yeah. What about any other comments from our panelists?
I think the reason that Alistair used to be in the same corridor as the vice chancellor when he was at Birmingham was the vice chancellor wanted to keep an eye on you. He knew what you're really like. I think the tide is turning. There's a big opportunity coming up, and that is the cap coming off student numbers over the next 2 years. And that creates an unrestrained and more flexible market. And that is a big opportunity for business schools, who have a track record of attracting students, as the figures have shown. So the opportunity there in terms of even more demand and growth is significant, and I think that's an opportunity for marketing to really seize. And nobody's really talked about that. Everybody's talking at the moment about the numbers, so how do we afford it? What facilities do we need that are extra? What extra staff or whatever? But the reality is it's the opportunity for marketing to take a leap forward there. That's one observation. I've got some sort of remedies to propose to you about how to help this issue of putting business school marketing to the forefront of the minds of the leadership of a university. And the first one, I think, came up earlier, was about the role of leadership. So if you have a dean of a business school that is now a vice-chancellor, obviously that is a good opportunity, and I know of only one of those. I don't know if you, and that's Ulster Business School, Richard Barnett. If you have the dean of the business school who is a marketeer, Ruth is a prime example of that, and Amanda Broderick at Salford is another example, then obviously you've
and
got...
Angus, of course.
And Angus Lang at Loughborough. So you've got champions there who should be fighting your cause, Ruth, if they're not already doing that. So there's a leadership opportunity. I think there's an opportunity for the academic culture. One of the big issues has always been that academics over time have not really regarded business and management subject areas as worthwhile academic subject matter compared to the classics, the historic legacy of higher education. And I think encouraging more business school academics to demonstrate their value to academia is also a major opportunity. And I certainly think that's an opportunity for the Association of Business Schools as a collective campaign to push forward. There's some nitty-gritty things, and two things for you particularly in marketing. One is about resource planning. In consultancy, if you work in consultancy, you're very much driven by the time you have available and the priorities that you afford to that time. Yet when you're in-house, you don't tend to do that mapping of how much time have I got in a given period, and therefore what have I got to do with that time to map out the priorities so that inevitably I will have to drop certain things that are pretty tactical and insignificant but are there for political reasons. So I think if you could operate a kind of mathematical model that shows what your hours are available in a given week, month, year, whatever, and then you allocate that to the main priorities to be done, that shows that what you internally the case for what you have to let go of and not attend to or get additional resource for. And finally, but most importantly, I think, is employers, the power of employers in all this, because business schools have ready-made access to employers through the nature of the work that they do, educating business leaders of the futures and so on. And that is understated, because universities as a whole need more employers to be engaged with them, not just for graduate recruitment purposes, but for consultancy, applied research, executive training, whatever it is. So the power of owning those relationships with employers that rests with the business school is another powerful dynamic in all this to explore.
Thank you. That was a very full answer there. So I don't know whether there's any comments people want to make, or perhaps, you know, some identification of where you fit in here. George, have we got the microphone here? Lovely, thank you.
I have a question to Anne about the hard subject of metrics and data, which seems to be the necessary evil. And I see this at business schools wherever I go. The professor who happens to teach this gets the lowest student evaluation. What can schools do to make this subject more interesting, sexier, given that it is a difficult, it takes a lot of work?
That's a great question. Ruth and I were catching up earlier, because I've only got 18 months of CIM history. She has many more years. Apparently the predecessor to the metrics option was always the least acceptable option. And because it was optional, people didn't do it. And the reason that when it was done, it was equally unpopular was that the people teaching it, and I'm trying to be kind here, didn't make it sexy.
Yeah.
It was occasionally done by someone from the finance department. It was possibly done by someone who thought numbers, not words. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, if we were to do psychometrics on most of the people in the room, you're probably going to be more verbal than your numbers. I'm somewhere in the middle because I've done them. I think it needs the right content in whatever the course is, wherever it is, whether it's as part of an MBA or part of our quals. I think it needs to be relevant. What am I going to get out of doing something I hate? Employability. Would be the answer to that. You will be a more successful marketer and more employable and more portable if you learn not to be scared of metrics. And any time I get that question, that's the answer I give, is do you want a career or you want to be pigeoned in a box as a colouring in person? If the answer is the first one, you might want to do metrics. Is that okay?
Thank you, Anne. Comments? questions for the panel. One at the back there, please.
If you could just say your name and where you're from.
Hi, it's Andrea from SMRS. Anne mentioned that if we're not in control of pricing, we're doomed. Now, and then Justin mentioned about the cap coming off. Now, one of the things that we face, particularly in undergrad, is that we have very little control of pricing, even if we can get it in our institutions, because of the stipulations put on us by government. I mean, if we're in this situation where we're doomed, if we don't have control of pricing, how do we reconcile that?
I'll do it from a non-business school perspective. I don't get it, I must admit. And I was lucky in that my first company was an American company. They brought everybody in as sales and marketing professionals first, and then you went elsewhere. And if you were in the marketing department, as I was, you did pricing. So I priced all of the textbooks across EMEA for everything that came out of the States. And every job I went to after that was for a commercial operation where marketers drove pricing because they're the ones who did the market research, they went and talked to the customers. So for me now to hear what was said, that you don't have it, I just don't get it. And when this research came out and I realised how many sectors marketing has lost control of one of the P's, shocks me and probably shows that CIM's got a bit to do to try and help you get it back. So I couldn't talk from a business school perspective, but certainly as someone who is a marketer who used to do that and it was a fundamental part of my job, I'm amazed. Do the other gentleman next to me?
You. Should I just add also, I mean, from our institution, obviously you've got 9K per student, basically, we're at. But when we first were looking at fees, the marketeers weren't included, actually, which was a bit odd, but we didn't know how, obviously, it was going to pan out. And I think one of the real things now is, obviously, this raft of products that we have within a business school, from, as I say, apprenticeships that we are now developing with the councils and local industry, right through to our doctorate, our postgraduate programmes internationally, etc. We do have an opportunity, I hope, as marketeers, to get involved there. But the undergraduate, to me, the value of the marketeers is really to work out where the bursaries come in and how we work the added value and how we put that proposition together for that fee that we are all in the same boat for, unfortunately.
I think it's not only pricing, I think it's product development portfolio. It's never been in the higher education sector, it's always been down to the academic interests, usually of one person. I'm interested in studying this area, so will others. If I want to teach a programme, I'll set it up on the basis of my own expertise. That's the way it's evolved. But I think pricing and product development, what's linked back is choice now, and choices and the cap coming off will drive choices to certain places more than others now, and that will have an impact on, you know, so what do? Do we change our portfolio? Do we offer new things that are attractive and increase choice? And do we change our pricing? I mean, I know there are limits set by government, but you can change prices downwards. There's no evidence, actually, of price being a differentiator, certainly in the undergraduate market. In the postgraduate market, slightly different, and in the MBA market, it is a factor, certainly. But I think that the choice factor is what will create that opportunity to look at pricing more immediately.
I think it's interesting we're talking about the cap and undergraduate cap and the link to removing the cap to pricing and product development, because I think you'll actually find there will be a greater role for marketers in pricing product development when the cap's removed, because the cap is not only an opportunity, it's actually a big threat for a lot of institutions, because what it ends is basically quotas. So at the moment, if you are a so-called leading top institution which has far more applicants than places, when you fill up, those students then need to look for the next step down, the next step down, the next step down. So it means that if your institution perhaps with a weak brand who perhaps isn't very well regarded, you're likely to get some students because, in fact, the people who are more popular than you are full. I think when you remove a cap, you've suddenly got a situation where technically any institution could expand to an unlimited extent. So you lose those sort of quotas, which I think means that pricing and product become a lot more important. And I think you will find there are certain universities, certain business schools, where suddenly people will realise they need marketers to help them on their pricing and product development, because otherwise they're just not going to be able to compete in a market where the cap's removed. And the other thing I think we should say is that people are presuming that removing the cap will have a sudden burst of additional students. Certainly evidence I've seen is that the demand is still relatively soft when you take the cap off. So the figures being bandied around by the government of, sort of 60,000 extra students in the next first year the cap's removed, I think is very unlikely. Yes, there are that many more applicants, but whether many of those applicants will actually convert into going to university, I think is doubtful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Other comments, questions? Here we are. We have lady in white.
Where you from?
Thank you. Samantha from Leeds University Business School. It's just an observation, really. You've just been talking about portfolio and price, which are two areas where... certainly in my experience of having been in higher education marketing for about 10 years, but quite new to business schools, I think there has been quite limited access to. I think despite a comment I made to a lady at the table earlier, I think there is increasing access, and I do see that, an increasing influence. And it just made me reflect on one of the points somebody made earlier about the relationship between marketers and academics within the business school, because I see that as a really, really... key relationship across the whole of the university, but obviously business school currently, and it's kind of building that trust as well, and not being seen as something very, very separate. And I think it's quite hard work and it can be challenging, but I think the way forward to get more influence is by that relationship building with academics. I don't know, you know, if anybody else agrees, and different schools have different models, but I think it's quite important.
Does anyone want to respond to that?
And just to say, I entirely agree. I think that relationship is crucial. I think something that Anne may have more to say on, but I think marketing being seen as a real profession within universities, I think, is an important part of that. If there's a legal issue at a university, I would imagine that there's certain respect would be given to the legal department for their expertise and skills. When there is a marketing issue at a university, it's not always the same respect isn't always shown to marketing colleagues. And I think building up the reputation of marketing as a true profession, I think, is part of getting that access, that influence, and that respect that's important to be able to do jobs properly.
I'll give Alistair his £10 later. What can I say? Coming to a point that was made earlier about how wonderful it must have been to work with 136,000 lawyers as part of a membership body with the governance of 100 of them that met 10 times a year. No. But the point is well made. The problem marketing has as a profession, and it's partly shared by human resource professionals, is it's not regulated other than in advertising. It's discretionary, as is our membership, and it's a huge range of activities. You know, everybody could probably say, maybe not in the 15 words that Andrew said, but what an accountant does for a business.
Yeah.
If you were to ask a layperson on the street what a marketer does for the business, you're going to get 25 answers depending on their experience of it. So as a profession, we're very wide-ranging. But one of our jobs is to get you recognised as a profession so that you are the go-to place for those kind of skills. I think it's work in progress.
I think one of the issues for me is in our institution, we have an international department that does marketing. We also have the recruitment department that does marketing, and we have marketing. I don't know whether that's similar in some of your institutions, but to me, it's a little odd, isn't it, for what we're doing as a joined up... probably in some institutions it's not the case, but for somewhere as big as us, it is a little bit difficult, very difficult, I think. OK, more comments, more questions, more suggestions, perhaps? I mean, what do we think are the barriers that we're facing in the profession in HE? Is it the understanding of vice-chancellors? Because a lot of them are science and engineering backgrounds, aren't they? They're not really business people, which a point was made up there, I think, Justin. Are there other barriers that you see in this? Or how? Let's perhaps look at how can the Association of Business Schools help in this area as well? Because obviously we have a chairman at the moment who is Angus from Loughborough, University, who is a dean, a marketing dean, and he's doing a lot on changing and moving policy, which I think is wonderful, really taking the Association of Business Schools forward. And a lot of you will know about the charter mark that ABS is launching this week, Stephanie, isn't it? It's tomorrow, isn't it? We've got the first tranche, which is all about working with Lord Young and looking at basically the SMEs and how we as business schools can work with those. So ABS really has got a voice in moving policy forwards. Now, that voice is also very useful internally within universities as well, to get that understanding through to vice chancellors about really what your roles are within universities. Any more issues or comments or questions?
I think they're all hungry.
I was thinking that myself. Oh, we've got one. Yeah. Hang on.
Jumping ahead. Hi, I'm Paul Hebron from Aston Business School. I just wanted to ask the panel, I was interested to see on one of the slides about the behaviours, and one of them was influencing. How do you think we could embed perhaps marketing and alumni relations activities better in the institution to get people working with us?
Well, it was my slide, so I'll take responsibility for it. I think some marketers, despite the fact we're a creative, networking, people-oriented industry, really bad influencing outside the box, and some of it's language. And that's what I was hinting at earlier, which is if you're going to go and talk to the finance manager, the finance director, the CFO, you're going to have to use a slightly different language to be taken seriously and to have influence. So depending on which market you're talking to, you know, as marketers, you would hopefully flavour your marketing depending on your target audience. I think to have influence as a professional within your organisation, small or large, you're going to have to do exactly the same as an individual. So if you're presenting to the board, it's a totally different spiel. If you're presenting to the accountants, learn to count. You know, don't do fluffy. And that sounds dreadful. You can do fluffy when you go back in. Don't do fluffy. But it's not like I'm going to do serious today and then I'll just go back in the box. You just have to change the way you behave on an almost daily basis. Sorry.
Okay.
No, I completely agree. It depends on who your audience is and who you're trying to influence, and I think you need to change your style and approach to do that. I think there's two common things that we're thinking about when you're developing marketing plans. The number of times I see a marketing plan or a marketing strategy that has very little relation to the institutional plan or institutional strategy, and I think that can be a real problem. So somebody comes up with what looks like a great idea, they set out a very ambitious, exciting plan, but in fact it doesn't really link to any of the goals or objectives of the organisation as a whole. I'm actually a fan of not really having a completely separate marketing strategy, but actually separate marketing objectives. But in fact, it's how marketing can meet the objectives of the organisation of a whole. And I think that can often help you influence, and particularly influence at the senior levels. And the other thing, which seems obvious, but again is not always done that well, is monitoring and evaluation and making sure that you can really show the impact of what you're doing. So just doing it and showing that you can do it and do it very well doesn't actually mean it's worth doing. And I think sometimes you need to be really clear that before you start off anything, how do you show there is impact in what you've done? And actually that's common to all kind of organisations. It's something I'm grappling with the organisation I'm working at the moment is we do lots of stuff, we do lots of outputs, but actually what are our outcomes, what are our... And I think we all as marketing professionals have a duty to show that we've monitored, evaluated what we've done, we can really prove the impact of what we do.
Well, on the point of influence, I mean, what I've learned is about attitudes and behaviours are really important, because if you have a positive, solution-driven attitude to things, which actually isn't very prevalent in higher education because it is full of negativity and it's easy to moan and groan about things and just add fuel to the fire, but if you have an attitude which is about, actually, I've got some ideas here to put to the table, positive ways of addressing problems and doing things, then I think people are willing to hear that and take that on board. So it is about coming out of the negativity and the moaning and thinking about more positive attitude to doing that. So, I think marketing professionals generally are positive people, but if you get, when I was in higher education, the university culture does get you down at certain times. It's probably the understatement of the year. But you learn to work within that over time, and you develop your own ways of working in that. But as long as you come up with ideas and solutions consistently, then that's a key thing, really.
Okay, thank you. Have we got one last burning question that we'd like? Yes, we have. Super.
Hi, it's Jackie from the Open University Business School. I think this is probably for Anne initially. I think actually as an industry, we're pretty good at benchmarking against each other. From your recent research, is there another industry or anyone that really stands out as kind of going ahead so we could sort of maybe look outside of education for some inspiration?
Somebody earlier mentioned procurement, I think. So if I was to kind of do a bit of navel-gazing, CIM's issues are model-based, not CIM-based. So we need to be relevant, modern, engaging. All of the C-classes, I call them, so all the other individual discretionary spend bodies like us are in exactly the same place. Some are further ahead in their change programme, some are behind. The one that I would say gets it and that I benchmark the marketing profession against and us as a professional body against is SIPs. Which is interesting because it's procurement people who tend to make accountants look interesting and say no a lot and really don't like marketing because they just don't get it. But if I was to take SIPs as a body as an example, 3 years ago they were making 15 million. They had it split membership, education, training. They lost a million a year. They now have a turnover of 23 million and they make a million a year. And they have turned around the decline in membership, they've stabilised it and it's growing, but what they're doing is kite-marking entire departments. So they're going in and assessing procurement professionals and kite-marking them, I'd call it an academy, and giving them a SIPS-accredited badge. And they are building SIPS members as accredited professionals, not just the procurement geeks that you usually put at a room at the back behind the print room, in our instance. So I would say that SIPS is a good example of a professional body and an industry trying to turn itself into a profession. If I was to take CIPD as an example, again, both instances, I'd say as a profession, they were way ahead of us until about 3 years ago, and then they've slightly lost their way. They had actually gone a really long way to having being a chartered HR professional, a licensed to practice. It was on all the job adverts. It was what people recruited. It came with a badge. They've kind of gone backwards for no reason of their own. Actually, it was partly kind of staff turnover. And they're probably our closest in terms of benchmarking. We benchmark financially. We do better than most. We benchmark in terms of membership. We've lost fewer than most. But I'd still like the numbers to be up, not down. But as a profession, I would look at HR because it's discretionary procurement. And then debate profession, CMI. I'm a member of CMI because I never got around to cancelling. I think they're a genuinely good thing, so I give them 180 quid. But is being a manager a profession? No, it's just what you do on a day-to-day basis. Was it that kind of thing you were interested in?
Yes, that answers a lot of it. But also, a little add-on as well, just other more creative industries that are forging ahead in marketing terms as well.
Marketing is so diverse. We do sectoral, we do geographical, and we do hierarchical. So if we were to look at all the acronyms, TLAs, four-letter acronyms in the UK, who are good? I'd pick companies, not membership bodies, if that makes sense. I think our creative arts in the UK and beyond are pretty amazing. I think we do media brilliantly. I think we do new media really, really well, but don't give ourselves credit for it. I think our publishing industry, despite the fact I left publishing because I didn't want to be there because I could see the model dying, content is publishing and we're not bad. I think we're pretty good at infrastructure. I think our B2B marketing as almost a sector within a sector is pretty special. It's really difficult if you're one of the big three, big four debate to come differentiate, to use that word again. You know, a PwC and EY, no, there is a brand disaster. KPMG, look it up, do images, not good. They do really well in differentiating what is effectively a bunch of accountants and consultants selling exactly the same thing to corporates. So if I was to pick one, and I'm literally talking at the top of my head, I'd go for B2B in terms of the consultancy space. They do a good job with the same product.
Alistair?
Yeah, I would pick out actually the arts and culture sector as an interesting other sector to look at for marketing expertise. I've certainly recruited into a number of teams. I've managed people from arts and culture marketing backgrounds, and I think that crossover works very well, and I think some really interesting innovative practice. I think one of the reasons I picked that out actually is because they're usually very low budget, which is kind of relatively similar to a lot in higher education, whereas with business, although there's some great practice, it often goes with quite large budgets as well. So yeah, arts and culture sector. That's good.
Super. Thank you. I think unless there's a last burning question, we've come to the end of the questions session.